Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, the rest of a prisoner of war's story. Shot down over Germany, a prisoner for 8 months. This time we'll hear about his liberation and what he found special joy in sailing past on his journey home.
Well, that was thrilling to see that. You could almost spit at it. We were, at least that's the way it felt.
His military work after World War II is pretty fascinating as well, and you'll hear all about it today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that takes you back in time. As we visit each time with World War II veterans, we're reminded that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have done things you probably can't imagine for the sake of our freedom. For example, if you played 18 holes in Bakersfield, California this week and saw a spry 93-year-old sinking a long putt for par, you'd probably be a little bit impressed. I'm guessing you'd be even more impressed if you found out that 93-year-old had spent 8 months as a guest of the Gestapo, as they say, a prisoner of war in Germany. If you listened to the program last time, you heard Robert Farwell explain how that all came about. It's not too often that an interview has to encompass a second episode of Hometown Heroes, but with Mr. Farwell, we just couldn't shrink it all down to fit into one. So we're going to hear the rest of his story this time. If you didn't hear part one, here comes a quick little refresher course. Originally from Duluth, Minnesota, Mr. Farwell joined the Army Air Corps before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. He spent the early years of America's involvement in the war training bomber pilots stateside. In 1944, he headed over to Europe to take over as a squadron commander with the 306th Bomb Group. He just needed to complete 5 missions in his B-17 before he'd earn that title, but that 5th mission on September 12, 1944, saw German fighter planes come head-on and unleash a hail of gunfire. It started a fire in his cockpit, another in the number 3 engine, and Major Farwell had to give the orders to bail out. If you caught all that last time, I don't think you'll mind hearing a little bit of that again. I asked Mr. Farwell what he saw and experienced as he exited that burning airplane.
Well, I knew that there was a lot of flak. There was a lot of any airplanes. There was a lot of metal flying around. So I said, I knew that we'd been briefed that the cloud formation, the tops were at about 18,000. And the bottom of the formation was at about 4,000. So I said, I'm going to wait until I can see the ground before I open my chute, because otherwise you've got falling airplanes, you've got flak all over the place. So when I got down to the point where I was just ready to come out of the clouds at about 4,000 feet, then I pulled the ripcord and, the parachute took me down.
All right, I always try to imagine myself in the situation that the veteran is experiencing here, and this has got to be right up there with some of the scariest. In my mind, you're free-falling blindly through clouds for 14,000 feet.
From 28,000 to 4,000 feet, whatever that is.
24,000 feet, free-falling without seeing anything, really.
No, I was in the clouds.
What in the world is going through your head?
I was waiting to see the ground.
Were you scared at all?
Not really. You don't have time to get scared. You just they're just picking what do you have to do, what do you do, what are you going to do, where's the ground, and that's about it.
So you pull your chute, and then I imagine everything slows down a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. By the time the chute opens and everything's calmed down, you're probably at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And fortunately, I'm about 40 miles just east of Berlin, and it's just farm country. And I'm floating down there looking at a hay field, level and flat. When I'm at about 1,500 feet, I see a farmer with a pitchfork running towards where I'm going to be landing, and as I landed, he's there right with me. So there was no evasion, no escape, no nothing. So, as the saying goes, for you the war is over.
Yep, and he told us about becoming a prisoner of war, eventually taken to Stalag Luft I in Barth, Germany, where the food and Red Cross parcels helped keep him alive. He did lose a good deal of weight, but would have lost a lot more if he had to rely on the occasional potato or that infamous German bread made with tree flour. That's a euphemism for sawdust, of course. That's pretty much where we left off last time, with Mr. Farwell in the POW camp, believing that his freedom would be regained someday. And that's where we're going to pick it up now.
Another thing that you brought home with you was this wartime log. And there's some evidence in there of how you spent a lot of your time as a prisoner. And I understand you kind of helped other guys keep their minds occupied, too.
Yeah, we had... We did the best we could. We arranged in September, October, and early November time periods. We had a bunch of baseball teams. Every one of the buildings put a team. We probably had a half a dozen baseball teams and ran a little league. And I arranged to have a basketball coming through the Red Cross. I had a basketball and a net. I needed a pole and a backboard. So I arranged with the Germans to put a pole in and enough wood to have a backboard so that I could put up this net. The pole went in the ground. One day, the next morning, the pole was gone.
Can't let you have too much fun, huh? You know, I think for the baby boomer generation, when they think of prisoners of war, maybe the first thing that comes to mind is the long-running TV show Hogan's Heroes. And some of the real POW stories we've heard on this show sound a little more like those fictionalized plot lines than others. So I think people can maybe imagine a Sergeant Schultz type tearing down your basketball hoop. But was this the guards just being mean, or is it something you think that was maybe just lost in translation?
Some of the guys, they didn't understand what was going on, so they pulled the pole down, and how they cut it up, I don't know, but... They did, and it ended up being firewood in a couple of the lodges.
So much for that. Maybe they were just bitter that the USA had come onto German soil and won the Olympic gold medal in basketball in Berlin in 1936. And one of the things I was referring to in relation to your wartime log, there are some very well-done watercolors of downhill skiers that you created in captivity. Did you learn to paint while you were a POW?
Well, I did those, but I had a little, this stuff earlier, so it was just something to do.
Yeah, you had to keep your mind occupied, to keep going and going and hoping you would eventually taste freedom again.
When that liberation came, what was that like for you? I'm sure you had dreamt about that moment for a while.
Oh, yeah, it was an exciting time. What happened is the Russians were coming close. The Germans were going to, they said, no, I'll get ready. We're gonna walk west and get out of here. And Zemke talked to the German commander and said, we're not going.
This is Colonel Hub Zemke, who is a P-47 ace, I believe, right?
He is Colonel Zemke. He actually, he headed a P-51 outfit at that time, the same group that Jerry Johnson and Gabreski were in. He was the commander.
Yes, Johnson was your roommate there at Stalag Luft I, and you mentioned another ace pilot, Gabby Gabreski, who was also a prisoner of war there. And after I get your take on Zemke's impact, I think we might take a little detour. I've actually had the privilege of interviewing several prisoners from this specific camp, Stalag Luft I, and we've alluded to Zemke's impact before, but when you take the time to examine it, I think his story is really pretty remarkable. There are so many examples of one man's courage having a great impact on his fellow soldiers, or fellow airmen in this case. And even though we're focusing on Mr. Farwell's experience, I think a nutshell sketch here is going to make it clear that Hub Zemke's character and courage had an impact on Mr. Farwell and every other prisoner at Stalag Luft 1. So we'll elaborate on that in a moment. But first, what's your understanding of how Zemke intervened? He was the ranking American there, so he basically represented all the American prisoners in dealing with the Germans?
Right. He was the ranking American. And he told the Germans, you know, we're not going to go if you force us to leave. You know, the war's over. We're going to find you, and you're going to be in trouble. And the next morning, all the Germans were gone. And we just waited. Some of the guys took off, you know, heading west. But, 99% of the people, and there were 8,000 of us, waited. And in a couple of days, B-17s flew in and took us all to a place in France where we spent about a week.
Is that Camp Lucky Strike?
Yeah, Camp Lucky Strike. All of us probably put on about 10 pounds. Because all of a sudden there was all sorts of food.
Yeah, I've had some guys tell me they got a little too excited, ate too much, and got sick.
Yeah, I think that happened to a lot of people.
But not you, huh?
Not me, no.
Good thing. And again, there are always a lot of what-ifs on this show. I do think this is a big what-if. And you can find much more along these lines online if you do some research. You can even find video of prisoners being evacuated from Stalag Luft 1 68 years ago. But let's focus on Hub Zemke for a moment, because his bravery certainly impacted Mr. Farwell and all those other prisoners. Bear with a little monologue from yours truly here as I give you a little background on Hubert Zemke. He was born in Missoula, Montana, the son of German immigrants, grew up speaking German and English, and he picked up the nickname Hub as a promising teenage boxer. When he was 22, his friends talked him into trying out for pilot training, and he joined the Army Air Corps in 1936. He was one of those Americans who was actually flying in the war before the U.S. was in the war, because Zemke went to England in 1940, flew as a combat observer with the Royal Air Force. At that point, he studied both the RAF and the German Luftwaffe and how they operated. That would come in handy later. In 1941, still before Pearl Harbor, Zemke was sent to the USSR. He helped train Russian pilots flying P-40 Tomahawks on a lend-lease program with the U.S. Once America did enter the war, Zemke checked out the P-47 Thunderbolt and commanded the 56th Fighter Group. That was the first group to fly the P-47, and a group that would receive great acclaim. They called them Zemke's Wolfpack because of the remarkable success in shooting down enemy aircraft that that group enjoyed. Zemke became an ace three times over in the P-47. In August of 1944, he transferred to the 479th Fighter Group to fly the new P-51 Mustang. In fact, he's thought to be one of the first to shoot down a German jet fighter while he was flying his Mustang. But on October 30th, 1944, in what was his 154th combat mission of the war, Hub Zemke's P-51 lost a wing in unexpected turbulence, and he had to bail out over enemy territory. Now you know how he ended up with Bob Farwell and 8,000 others at Stalag Luft 1. Although, actually, there is quite a story about some Zemke heroics between his capture and the time he ended up at Stalag Luft 1. They say the train he was being transported in came under fire by Allied fighter planes. We've heard POWs describe moments like that. Apparently, Zemke realized that he wasn't going to be able to escape, but he also realized the fighters were coming back around for another pass, and he went back into the rail car and rescued two German girls from the line of fire. That action earned him a certain degree of respect from his captors, and it gave him a little bit of standing as the unofficial commander of all the Allied prisoners at Stalag Luft 1. As Mr. Farwell described, when Russian forces were closing in and the camp commandant ordered all the prisoners to march out of Stalag Luft 1, Zemke refused that order, and communicating clearly in the German he had learned as a boy in Montana, he convinced the Germans to leave quietly in the night and essentially turn Stalag Luft 1 over to the prisoners. Remember, he had also helped train Russian pilots before America entered the war, so now 5 years later, when the Russians arrived in Barth, he used the little Russian language he had picked up to befriend those incoming forces, and arranged for all the prisoners to be flown out of there in B-17s. Now, who knows how it all would have turned out if Colonel Zemke had not been there, but that's a little background. Robert Farwell remembers all of that. He still has his Kriege card, the German index card with his mugshot and the POW number 5674. You can find a photo of that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, a reminder of those 8 months as a prisoner of war. But I guess there is a question I need to ask you.
What did it feel like to be a free man again? And did you have a little perspective on what freedom meant after spending 8 months as a prisoner?
It was really great. I mean, it was a thrilling thing to be out. You know, you really felt great. And then the big thing then was, when am I going to get out of here and get home?
Yeah, you had a wife to go hunt down.
Yeah.
And how did that unfold? What was that like?
We ended up at Camp Lucky Strike. We were there, we were probably there about a week. And then we ended up on a ship that left Le Havre and landed in New York. We were all given the ability to get to a phone. And so actually I called my sister-in-law because there was at the family ranch where my wife was living. They didn't have a phone yet. So sister-in-law lived in Bakersfield. I got a hold of her. Then I managed to get my wife at her place, and I talked to my wife a couple of times, and she ended up going up to Sacramento to we ended up getting on a train and going across the country, dropping people off on the way. And I ended up then in Sacramento and met my wife at a hotel there.
What was it like to actually see her face again?
It was great. Yeah. It's hard to describe.
From the sound of it, you never doubted that that was going to happen. And you haven't struck me as an overly sentimental guy or one that gets too emotional about things. But I've had a lot of other POWs tell me that when they sailed into New York Harbor, that there was something else they saw that had a particular significance to them. Did you see the Statue of Liberty? Did it mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah. We went right past it, you know. No, that was thrilling to see that. You could almost spit at it. We were, at least that's the way you felt. No, that was a great sight. It was a good moment.
I think a lot of people assume, hey, if I went off to war, I got shot down, could have easily died, survived 8 months as a POW, that's enough of the military for me. But that wasn't the way you thought about it.
No, I didn't. I stayed in. I loved to fly. I stayed in until November of 46. When the war was over with, I was stationed at various places, Castle and San Bernardino, I decided to get out. I said, if I'm not going to be a permanent regular officer, you know, I don't want any part of it. I got out of the service and applied to go to school at USC and Stanford, and I was accepted to both. But I went to USC because I could start in January. Stanford was on a quarter system, and I couldn't start there until March. So that's how I ended up going to USC.
But you weren't there long before the military came back and said, hey, we've got a job for you after all.
In May, I got a message from the Air Force that I was offered a regular commission. And I replied, I said, I like that very much, but I'm in school. And I'd like to finish the year so that the credits are worth something. And they said, well, when's the school over with? And I said, it finishes on the 1st of September. And they said, well, you've got until the 1st of September to make up your mind then. About a week before classes were over, we were in final exams, I got a hold of the Air Force and said, yes, I'd like to come back in. So they said, okay. Just wait for orders, and that's what I did.
And what was your expectation? Did you think you'd be back in the air flying again, or what were you anticipating?
Oh, yeah, I figured I would continue flying. And so on, the Air Force did not have a program for doctors at that time, which I was in pre-med, and I asked them about. But they said, still have a program where you can finish if your education was cut short or interfered with by the war. So as soon as I got my orders and back at Merced at Castle, I penned in for training for the Civil Institutions Program. And I was accepted after a few months. And that's the way I ended up at USC in the civil engineering program.
So you left USC to go back into, I guess, what was still the Army Air Corps at that time, and then they sent you back to USC to study engineering.
Yes, went back to USC for 2 years. Graduated, got my civil engineering degree. For the last week, just waiting for orders, where I was going to go next.
And you would end up in the Air Force all the way until 1966. You first entered the National Guard in 1936. So for the better part of 30 years, you were serving our country. But what you did those last 15 years or so in the Air Force was a lot different from what you were doing in World War II. And we're going to explore that when we come back. 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California, our guest again today. Speaking of Bakersfield, we had a gentleman named Don Westfall on last month talking about Minterfield Air Museum, where he continues to volunteer as a docent 70 years after he trained there as a pilot. Since that episode with Don, the original Roadhouse Grill in Bakersfield has stepped up to sponsor Don's journey to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. through Kern County Honor Flight. I'm really excited for you, Don. And hey, original Roadhouse Grill, well done. No matter where you're listening to Hometown Heroes today, there is an Honor Flight hub pretty close to you, and I'm about to tell you more about that. We'll get back to Robert Farwell's story when Hometown Heroes continues next after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our interview with 93-year-old Robert Farwell. Before we're done, we're going to talk about one of the prestigious medals he earned. We've heard about what he did in World War II and how he survived 8 months as a prisoner of war. When we left off, he was back in the Air Force, as it had become by then. He had a civil engineering degree from USC, and right after you graduated in 1950, while war was brewing in Korea, you found yourself in another part of the world. Where did they send you, and what were you doing?
I got orders to go to Wheelis Field, Libya, which is in North Africa. At that time, Wheelis had been a World War II base. It had been inactive from the time the war ended until now in the summer of 50. They decided to open it again, and I ended up going there as the base civil engineer.
So what did they have you do? What was your task that you had to finish?
Well, the task was to maintain what was there, but actually there was very little going. There was one power station that had a couple of old diesel engines in it. There was very little housing. All of the housing that existed at the time were the old World War II stuff that was built by the Italians. Oh, the runways were a mess. No barracks, no housing, not much of anything, so... The task was to start the repairs and start the rebuilding at Wheelis Field, which we did.
So I don't want to exaggerate. I don't want to give you too much credit or too little here, but it sounds like you oversaw the complete renovation of that base.
Yes. After a short time, I was there patching the runways and started to build some barracks. The Army decided to bring in the Corps of Engineers because we're facing a major rehaul and rebuilding program. So the Corps came in and established their headquarters there, and then they took over the major construction program, resurfacing the airfields, extending the runways, building barracks, rehabbed a hospital. But as the base engineer, I worked with them on planning and everything else, and then in the meantime, my responsibility was to maintain everything else. And then I was responsible for accepting the finished work from the Corps. And so I gave the final inspection and signed off the papers for the Air Force.
So this is all more than 60 years ago. The U.S. operated that base until 1970, when it was turned over to the Libyan government after Muammar Gaddafi had overthrown King Idris. The U.S. actually bombed that airbase in 1986 when Ronald Reagan sent in that group of F-111s against Gaddafi. And yes, that airfield that Mr. Farwell renovated, it is still there in Tripoli. In fact, it figured fairly prominently in Libya's civil war in 2011. So a lot of history has unfolded on that ground you were moving in the early 1950s. But what about
just the experience of being there in that part of the world for that time? Was that eye-opening for you?
Well, yes, it was. Libya at the time was basically the poorest country in the world. There was very, very limited agricultural land right near the ocean, and the rest of the place was just desert. At that time, in the late 40s, early 50s, I think the population of Libya was 1 million, maybe 1.5 million Arabs, and a few Italians, and that was about it.
Your globetrotting was just beginning, because the military had a few other destinations for you. Where did you go from there?
Well, from Libya, I went back to the States at Westover.
After Libya and after the Korean War, America was not technically at war, but we look back on that period now as the early days of the Cold War. And you had a role that was quite related to the Cold War that sent you all over the world. What were you doing with a program called MATS, and what does that stand for?
MATS is the acronym for Military Air Transport Service. And I was in Washington then. As I said, my responsibility was building the overseas air bases, Keflavik, the Azores, North Africa, Doran, and Saudi Arabia. We rebuilt Hawaii, the base at Hickam, and then Johnson Island. We were responsible for the development in Japan in that area, but somebody else took that part of the Far East Pacific over. I didn't have anything to do with that.
So you mentioned Iceland, the Azores, North Africa, Hawaii, where Hickam Field was. These are some interesting destinations, and you had to go to each one of these sites and design things for them?
Well, we designed it out of the States when I was at Andrews. Of course, we used architect engineers, private firms to do the engineering and the architecture, but I was responsible for directing that enterprise. It was a very, very interesting program, and I got a lot done.
And why was it so important to have all these bases in those locations, in the grand scheme of things with world geopolitics of the day?
Well, at this time, what was going on was known as the Cold War. And it was really a race with the Russians to be certain that we could withstand any attack that they put on. So we were very busy expanding our radar networks, our early warning networks, like I say, in Iceland and Newfoundland and northern Canada. That stuff was designed by us out of MATS. I would periodically take visits to all these places. I spent a lot of time in Iceland.
I'm curious, too, because of your background and what you'd been through previously. Here you'd been shot down by the Germans, prisoner of war, subject to Hitler's forces. And I think it's easy for people now to look back on that and say, boy, what a tumultuous time in world history. But I'm curious how the feeling you had during the Cold War and all these duties that you had, did you feel as much gravity, as much importance, maybe as much concern for the future of the world during the Cold War as you did as a POW?
You know, it was a real fight going on there at that time. We perhaps overrated the Russian Mentons, but at that time they were bent on world domination. They were about to take over most of Europe. Frankly, it was our determination and for us, stationing troops in France and Germany and Italy to make sure that the Russians didn't take over the whole thing.
When you think about all those years you spent doing that kind of work, going over plans for this base and that base, and many of those bases are still there, some of them still in use today. What are you most proud of with that work that you did?
Well, probably the at that time period, the most most important project that I had that we completed was a communications program from the States. We built what we call tropospheric scatter stations from the States into northern into Canada, to Greenland, to Iceland, to Scotland, and then all over Europe, so that by the time that was finished, anybody at any Army, Navy, or Air Force base in the States could pick up a phone and dial anybody in any station in Europe or North Africa, Turkey. That was a tremendous program and very, very successful.
I'm sure most of the people listening have no idea what this is. I mean, we live in the day and age now of cell phones triangulated from a satellite up there in the heavens somewhere. You didn't have this in the 50s and 60s. Who thought up this idea and how did it work?
Well, it was necessary to get the communications going. And that's the biggest reason for doing this. At that time, as I say, we had a radio network that worked, but it was one of those things where there was a lot of static, and when you talk to somebody and you got finished saying, you said, over, and then he could pick up the conversation to come back, but there was no just going back and forth like we can today. And by the time this program finished, that was over with. We got phone service, you know, throughout the world. That's just similar to what we do today.
In fact, this reached all the way into Vietnam during that war, and you received the prestigious Legion of Merit Medal for your work on this. But can you explain to us, in layman's terms, the technology of how this worked? Because I think some of our brainiac tech people out there will say, what in the world are these guys talking about? You would actually bounce radio waves off part of the atmosphere, is that right?
Yeah, what we call tropospheric scatter. Take huge, lot of power, and antennas that pointed at the sky in the direction you wanted to go, and the signal would bounce off the stratosphere, ionosphere, whatever you wanted to call it, and then be picked up at the farther station, for example. And from the U.S., we would go to northern Canada, from Canada to Greenland to Iceland there. And then once you were in Europe, it was a microwave all over the place, except that from England, we did tropospheric scatter to Spain, and then from Spain to North Africa and to Italy. Once we were in North Africa and Italy, we could cover the rest of it with microwave.
So the impact of this program was to greatly expedite communication, so you could get a message somewhere a lot faster than you used to be able to?
Yeah, when it was over with, you could pick up the phone any place and have a normal conversation like we can today.
And at the time, this technology wasn't available to anyone else. This was just the U.S. military that was capable of that?
I think so. I don't think anybody else could do that.
And what was your specific role in the implementation of that?
Well, my role was to build the facilities that housed the equipment, provide power, housing, and everything else for the crews that would stay there to operate this communication system. It meant building barracks and the buildings that house the transmitters and receivers and the antennas and so on. We designed, and basically the Corps of Engineers built all of this stuff all over.
And one of your stops was the capital city of another country that has produced quite a few headlines recently. What were you doing in Iran?
We were in Tehran because we were providing to the Iranians radar stations for early warning. We were furnished the equipment and the money, and they were building. And I went to Tehran, and probably there for maybe 10 days. And we traveled from Tehran to a couple of different locations in the western part of the country where they were building these early warning radar stations.
So this was all because of the threat of Russian missiles.
This was the Cold War. We were bound and determined we were going to be everywhere in the world, and that the Russians couldn't get there in front of us. So that was a pretty tense period.
Well, and I want to ask you about some of the other work you did in the Cold War, but I'm struck just listening to you and hearing you mention some of these locations and they're places that have been in the news a lot in the last couple of years. And both with your work in the military and with the Bechtel Corporation after you got out of the Air Force, you were in places like Saudi Arabia, very near to where the Gulf War took place, the part that you were in. You're in Tehran, where obviously that's been in the news nonstop in recent years, and in Libya, where the chaos has certainly been widespread. What's your perspective? How surreal is it for you to see all these news stories, the video that comes out of these places, and think back to the time you spent in all of them?
There are parts of this world that have almost always been chaotic. The whole Middle East, you know, even today with our support of Israel and Egypt, the whole place is a powder keg. It's an evolving story, and it's a dangerous place.
Did it seem that way then, or was it just that grander tension of the U.S. against the USSR and which country was going to choose which team, so to speak?
There was a contest between the Russians and us, have friends or dominate, if you want to put it that way, the different countries and the different cultures. In our part, primarily defensive, and we think, or thought at the time, on the Russians' part, as an antagonistic expansionist period. I'm not sure if the Russians agree to that, but that's what it seemed to us at the time.
And there was that threat of mutually assured destruction because of the nuclear capabilities of both of those superpowers. And when it came to what America did to prepare for or even prevent thermonuclear war, Mr. Farwell again played an interesting role. We're going to get to that when Hometown Heroes continues right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up a second program with 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California, originally from Duluth, Minnesota, and at different times along an Air Force career that spanned from the 30s to the 60s. He was a temporary resident of all kinds of interesting locations around the globe. Mr. Farwell was a prisoner of war in Germany during World War II. Of course, a few months after he was liberated, World War II came to an end thanks to America's use of nuclear technology at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 15 years later, you didn't need a B-29 to drop a nuclear bomb. Intercontinental ballistic missiles had become a reality. In fact, that warhead on an Atlas missile 15 years after World War II was 100 times more powerful, 100 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Nagasaki. The different iterations of Atlas missiles were followed by the Titan, the Titan II, the Minuteman, and our guest today was involved with all of those at a time when global tensions were fierce. So we're into the 1960s now. You're stationed at Norton Air Force Base in San Bernardino. And what all were you doing there?
I was made the deputy for civil engineering for the missile base stuff. And I had a responsibility for the engineering and oversight for the Atlas, the Titan, and the Minuteman, and a very, very limited advanced missile program that developed into the satellite kind of program that we're running now. But it was a very low-key effort at the time. Any aircraft and any missile program combined.
The Atlas and the Titan and Titan IIs, it was your job to draw up the plans or oversee the plans for the silos they would launch out of?
Yeah, that's right. Every place where we had missiles, we also had to build maintenance facilities, the basic weapon building where the weapons would come in, be assembled, warheads attached, and then taken to the sites. And each base had to have what we called a missile assembly building and a highly classified technically building to receive and store and activate the warheads.
I always try to imagine what it would be like to be doing your job or to be in your shoes, and it seems to me like you had to feel a great deal of responsibility. You know, you're always going to be responsible for your wife and kids, but in a lot of ways, you had a lot of the nation's responsibility on your shoulders.
Well, you did, and you felt it. You felt a very high level of responsibility to see that things happened and that they didn't go wrong, that they were right, and all of the work you were doing was not only important, but it was done right and it was going to be effective. It was a sobering task, frankly.
I would imagine so, and How often did you think about the real reason that you were doing this and the destructive power that these missiles could unleash if they had to be deployed?
It was important for us to get them built, get them established, get them in service. For one thing, we felt that if they were there, they were ready, that they were going to prevent a war and we would no longer need the B-29s and everything else that we still have going strong. And it's worked. We haven't had a war. We haven't had anything, a serious disruption. The Russian is no longer a threat whatsoever. In fact, no country is a threat anymore. The only real threats that we have today are the so-called terrorists and people like the Taliban and so on. Otherwise, things are in pretty safe mode.
Were there times during all those years, and obviously the Cuban Missile Crisis is one that comes to mind that a lot of people would gravitate toward, but were there times while you were working on this that you thought America may have to use these missiles, that something might actually happen?
That was in the back of your mind. What you wanted to do is make sure that if that ever happened, you know, the thing was going to work. As time went on, though, it became a feeling that, you know, it really wasn't going to happen, that things were getting calmer and that, you know, it was all going to work out all right. And so far it has.
Have you ever thought about or tried to quantify how many different missile sites or even missile silos that are there as a result of what you did?
Oh, Lordy. I sighted all the Atlas E's, and I was responsible for the design of the facilities for all of the Atlas F's, Titan II's. After that, the communication networks tied it all together.
When you think back about that entire Cold War period, and I know for the latter half of it, you were out of the service, still working in related industries, but what do you feel like your contribution was? Do you feel like you helped keep Americans safe, that you helped keep the U.S. out of global war?
I think I did important work in missile design and the communications systems that we put out all over the world, as well as being responsible for building quite a few air bases around the world. I don't dwell on it or try to articulate it, but the fact is I'm pretty proud of the work I did and its impact on providing safety for the American people. I'm proud of that.
You should be. I realize this is a tough question to answer, but with the unique role that you played and the access you had to different things, what's your best estimate or evaluation of how close we came to that mutual destruction that so many people feared when America and the USSR were both with their finger on the trigger?
Very, very close. The ones that people remember most and that much has been written about is, of course, the case when Kennedy was president. We put a Thor missile in Turkey. We had missiles in the UK. As a result, the Russians were going to put missiles in Cuba. And you remember that. That was a very, very tricky time period that could have led to a bloody war. Fortunately, we stayed resolved, and Khrushchev finally backed off and called off his ships that were carrying missiles and warheads to Cuba, and that was the end of it. We took our missiles out of Europe that were aimed at the Russians, and the Russians stayed out of Cuba. And that's where we are today. We've had, in this country, Minuteman missiles aimed at Russian targets for decades now. Since the Russians theoretically are no longer our enemy, I don't have any idea where our Minuteman missiles and Triton missiles on submarines are targeted. They probably have multiple targets. Hopefully, they'll never be used.
Amen. And I'm just... Again, I'm trying to get to what it must have been like for you. And with you having awareness and knowledge that the general public did not have, so you're aware in the 1960s that all these missiles are pointed at Russia, and all it needs is the command, and they'll be on their way, and then there's probably something coming back the other way.
Pointed at us, too, and we know that. And they're capable of intercontinental missiles, no question about it. I wasn't optimistic enough to feel that it would never happen. There was no point in dwelling on it, no point in worrying about it, and so I never did, frankly. I just did not expect anything like that to ever happen. And fortunately, it hasn't.
There's a little medal in your office back there that not too many guys can claim. In fact, I've interviewed 500 or 600 veterans, and I think I've only met a couple that were awarded the Legion of Merit. What did that mean to you when you found out you were receiving that prestigious award from our government?
It was very exciting and very fulfilling. I didn't know about it until the retirement. I was retiring. The retirement ceremony, General O'Neill tacked on the Legion of Merit on me, and that was very important. I was very, very happy with that. It's a good achievement. I'm proud of it.
When you think back about your entire career in the service and beyond, what are the things that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I had a successful flying career. I trained a lot of pilots in different airplanes, and I trained cadets for a full year here at Minner Field. I spent 2 years training B-17 crews and pilots. That's pretty satisfying. And then ended up, flying a lot. I ended up with over 4,000 hours. I had about 1,300 hours in a B-17, and just a scattering of several hundred hours in different airplanes.
Was there a favorite plane that you flew?
Well, obviously the B-17, and I have a lot of time in others too. I ended up with probably 1,300-1,400 hours in a C-47, because when the war was over, of course, there were no B-17s to fly. And so you flew a mix of airplanes, AT-6s, C-45s, B-24s, odds and ends all the time, and a little bit of B-29 time. I enjoyed flying. Wish I was still doing it.
If you had a chance to fly to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial with a bunch of other World War II veterans, would you want to do that?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I know they had one here a couple of months ago, and I understand they're going to have another one. And I'd be happy to go with them.
What about the cockpit? If they stuck you in that seat, you think you could manage things?
Oh, of course I could. It's been 40-50 years since I've flown an airplane, but I'm convinced I could still do it.
I'm not surprised. One thing I've noticed about you, you don't seem to get too caught up in any of the emotions of this, or you don't seem overly sentimental, but when I think back what you've told me about being a prisoner of war, here you are, a young man, you've got a wife back home, you don't have any children. You ever think about the fact that if you didn't survive getting shot down, if you didn't survive 8 months as a prisoner of war, your two sons would have never been born, and all these things we've talked about today would have never happened?
Well, I don't dwell on it, but you can't help but thinking about that on occasion. I was very fortunate, very lucky. It's gratifying to a certain degree to realize that you lived through all of this and survived and are still healthy. I've got a pain in the back every now and then, but I'm still playing golf a couple of times a week. I have two sons and a family that I see quite frequently.
Can you still shoot your age on the golf course?
I have several times. I shot my age when I was 92. I haven't made it during 93, but I'll hope I'll do it for again. But I first shot my age when I was 86, and I came close when I was 70. I was playing the Bakersfield Inn and Country Club, and I shot a 34 on the front side. And I thought, geez, if I can bar the backside, I'll shoot a 70. I didn't make it. I shot a 74.
But you got it at 86 and 87, 88.
so on and so forth. Did it again last year at 92, and I'm trusting a 93 is in your future. Thanks for taking us through your past, and I hope that honor flight trip is in your future too. That is 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California. Next week, we're going to catch some living history at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, where there are a couple of Navy vessels that can take you back in time to World War II. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.